Good evening, welcome back. Tonight on the 26th of February, we come to the conclusion of this lengthy chapter, which closes out part one of the first book, or part one of the second book in the Life Divine, The Origin and Remedy of Falsehood, Error, Wrong, and Evil. It's a wide-ranging chapter, touches upon many issues, but the primary elements deal with how ignorance arises, that it is a purposive self-limitation of knowledge made by the divine consciousness for reasons of cosmic deployment. There is no ignorance in the transcendence, in the absolute. Ignorance becomes possible only when posited as being and as consciousness in a universal setting. And that has application to the individual as well. Ignorance and the contraries associated with it serve some ultimate purpose. Falsehood and evil, as they arrive out of the play of ignorance in the universe, hail from these inconscient roots, the superconscient having become inconscient, but are signatures of a warp in the vital consciousness. These oppositions that confront us continually in our experience of the world are possible only in this manifested universe, beginning from the inconscient and moving upwards. The appearance of the individual in this cosmic scene, where the universe is beginning from a dark basis, is first seen not in the original life forms, but in the play of the ego. The ego in the self-affirming individual. And the self-affirming individual is necessarily in conflict with the universe, which won't give what it demands, and with others who won't obey. So the individual is always working between the surface nescience, which is the construct of the manifest universe, and the secret consciousness force, which is always present and guiding the progress and the definition of where the universe is taking us in its evolution. The ego does not know any of that. The ego is what separates the individual from the universe and the perception of this self from the next self. And it's an interesting thing that nature accepts the division of the ego, accepts even the arisal of evil from the play of the divided ego in order to get an ultimate good from it. So if things, in the parlance of humanity, in parlance of the mind and the divided consciousness that it has, sees that division is at the root of everything, that this is good over here and that is bad over there, and then suddenly know what was bad is now good and what was good is now bad, then these are necessary things through which nature insists that we evolve, that we have to experience these antinomies and realize that neither is definitive, neither is really true as true grounded in real being in the conscious force of the absolute. So ethical systems, as they arise, attempt to control the divisions in our natures, but are never successful in doing that, they try to coordinate and impose a moral order over our thought, our feeling, and our action. But as demonstrated in every instance of human life, ineffective and inadequate to that task. The method Sri Aurobindo has identified in the last paragraph, prior to where we begin tonight, identifies the principle of selection and rejection as the means of arriving at a greater good. Rejection, he points out, doesn't work so well because it's always grounded in the relative expedient, which will lose its expedience in the next moment. And he's going to find that we do better when instead of using rejection, we use a wise process of selection to build consciousness. So I think we can begin from there. The endeavor to select, to retain from our consciousness and action all that seems to us good, and reject all that seems to us evil, and so to reform our being, to reconstitute and shape ourselves into the image of an ideal, is a more profound ethical motive because it comes nearer to the true issue. It rests on the sound idea that our life is a becoming and that there is something which we have to become and be. But the ideals constructed by the human mind are selective and relative. To shape our nature rigidly according to them is to limit ourselves and make a construction where there should be growth into larger being. The true call upon us is the call of the infinite and the supreme. The self-affirmation and self-abnegation imposed on us by nature are both movements towards that, and it is the right way of self-affirmation and self-negation taken together in place of the wrong because ignorant way of the ego, and in place of the conflict between the yes and no of nature that we have to discover. If we do not discover that, either the push of life will be too strong for our narrow ideal of perfection, its instrumentation will break and it will fail to consummate and perpetuate itself, or at best, a half result will be all that we shall obtain, or else the push away from life will present itself as the only remedy, the one way out of the otherwise invincible grasp of the ignorance. So there is a call of the infinite that summons us out of the ignorance and through the yes and no of nature. There's a vital push which can insist on forward movement, but it's likely to break the relative confines, destroy the boundaries, the machinery of any morality we construct. And then there's, of course, the push away from life itself, a withdrawal into some kind of sanctified field above and outside the universe. And he continues, this indeed is the way out usually indicated by religion, a divinely enjoined morality, a pursuit of piety, righteousness, and virtue as laid down in a religious code of conduct. A law of God determined by some human inspiration is put forward as a part of the means, the direction by which we can tread the way that leads to the exit, the issue. But this exit leaves the problem where it was. It is only a way of escape for the personal being out of the unsolved perplexity of the cosmic existence. In ancient Indian spiritual thought, there was a clearer perception of the difficulty. The practice of truth, virtue, right will, and right doing, was regarded as a necessity of the approach to spiritual realization. But in the realization itself, the being arises to the greater consciousness of the infinite and eternal, and shakes away from itself the burden of sin and virtue. For that belongs to the relativity and the ignorance. Behind this larger, truer perception lay the intuition that a relative good is a training imposed by world nature upon us so that we may pass through it towards the true good, which is absolute. These problems are of the mind and the ignorant life. They do not accompany us beyond mind, as there is a cessation of the duality of truth and error in an infinite truth consciousness. So there is a liberation from the duality of good and evil in an infinite good. There is transcendence. So the dualities cease at some point. But we do find utility in the substance of morality in that it imposes some kind of an order upon the errant vital and mental nature of humanity and is necessary until we are prepared to outgrow it. It's a phase through which we move. We can grow to a point where we are beyond good and evil, as the saying goes in modern philosophy. But that requires a spiritual release from ego, not just a greatening of the ego until it wants to dominate the earth and all, but rather the disappearance, or at least the diminution of the ego and its replacement by the vast spiritual consciousness, or the emergence of the inner true soul, or ideally the fusion of both. He continues, there can be no artificial escape from this problem, which has always troubled humanity, and from which it has found no satisfying issue. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil, with its sweet and bitter fruits, is secretly rooted in the very nature of the inconscience from which our being has emerged, and on which it still stands as a nether soil and basis of our physical existence. It has grown visibly on the surface in the manifold branchings of the ignorance, which is still the main bulk and condition of our consciousness, and its difficult evolution towards a supreme consciousness and an integral awareness. So in other words, we have not yet escaped the grasp of the inconscience. It dogs us still. As long as there is this soil with its unfound roots in it, and this nourishing air and climate of ignorance, the tree will grow and flourish and put forth its dual blossoms and its fruit of mixed nature. It would follow that there can be no final solution until we have turned our inconscience into the greater consciousness, made the truth of self and spirit our life basis, and transformed our ignorance into a higher knowledge. All other expedients will only be makeshifts or blind issues. A complete and radical transformation of our nature is the only true solution. It is because the inconscience imposes its original obscurity on our awareness of self and things, and because the ignorance bases it on an imperfect and divided consciousness, and because we live in that obscurity and division, that wrong knowledge and wrong will are possible. Without wrong knowledge, there could be no error or falsehood. Without error or falsehood in our dynamic parts, there could be no wrong will in our members. Without wrong will, there could be no wrongdoing or evil. While these causes endure, the effects also will persist in our action and in our nature. So as long as our sight is not true, our actions cannot be true either, and will inevitably proceed to help endure the ignorance. A mental control can only be a control, not a cure. A mental teaching, rule, standard can only impose an artificial groove in which our action revolves mechanically or with difficulty, and which imposes a curbed and limited formation on the course of our nature. A total change of consciousness, a radical change of nature, is the one remedy and the sole issue. Now, this is the term, third time he's used the term issue in the last page or two. And he uses it in the original sense. For us, an issue is a topic, ordinarily, in American speech. But what issue means is a going or flowing out. It's an avenue of advance. So read it in that sense. A radical change of nature is the one remedy and the sole avenue of advance. We have to change our consciousness. It's not merely the topic at issue, it's the one way out. But since the root of the difficulty is a split, limited, and separative existence, this change must consist in an integration, a healing of the divided consciousness of our being. And since that division is complex and many-sided, no partial change on one side of the being can be passed off as a sufficient substitute for the integral transformation. Our first division is that created by our ego, and mainly, most forcefully, most vividly, by our life ego, which divides us from all other beings as not self and ties us to our egocentricity and the law of an egoistic self-affirmation. It is in the errors of this self-affirmation that wrong and evil first arise. Wrong consciousness engenders wrong will in the members, in the thinking mind, in the heart, in the life mind, and the sensational being, in the very body consciousness. Wrong will engenders wrong action of all these instruments, a multiple error and many branching crookedness of thought and will and sense and feeling. So this is a rapid inventory of our nature, isn't it? Nor can we deal rightly with others so long as they are to us others, beings who are strangers to ourselves, and of whose inner consciousness, soul need, mind need, heart need, life need, body need, we know little or nothing. The modicum of imperfect sympathy, knowledge, and goodwill that the law, need, and habit of association engender is a poor quantum of what is required for a true action. A larger mind, a larger heart, a more ample and generous life force can do something to help us or help others and avoid the worst offenses, but this too is insufficient and will not prevent a mass of troubles and harms and collisions of our preferred good with the good of others. By the very nature of our ego and ignorance, we affirm ourselves egoistically even when we most pride ourselves on selflessness, and ignorantly, even when we most pride ourselves on understanding and knowledge. Altruism takes as a rule of life, altruism taken as a rule of life does not deliver us. It is a potent instrument for self-enlargement and for correction of the narrower ego, but it does not abolish it nor transform it into the true self, one with all. The ego of the altruist is as powerful and absorbing as the ego of the selfish, and it is often more powerful and insistent because it is a self-righteous and magnified ego. It helps still less if we do wrong to our soul, to our mind, life, or body with the idea of subordinating ourselves to the self of others. To affirm our being rightly so that it may become one with all is the true principle, not to mutilate or immolate it. So the limits of otherness hamper even an expanded mind and heart. The limits of altruism only allow the ego to become sattvic. It becomes even more powerful, convinced of what good it is doing to others. Self-immolation, he writes, may be necessary at times, exceptionally for a cause in answer to some demand of the heart or for some right or high purpose, but cannot be made the rule or nature of life. So exaggerated, it would only feed and exaggerate the ego of others or magnify some collective ego, not lead us or mankind to the discovery and affirmation of our or its true being. Sacrifice and self-giving are indeed a true principle and a spiritual necessity. For we cannot affirm our being rightly without sacrifice or without self-giving to something larger than our ego. But that too must be done with a right consciousness and will founded on a true knowledge. To develop the sattvic part of our nature, a nature of light, understanding, balance, harmony, sympathy, goodwill, kindness, fellow feeling, self-control, rightly ordered and harmonized action, is the best we can do in the limits of the mental formation, but it is a stage and not the goal of our growth of being. These solutions, by the way, these are solutions, by the way. Palliatives, necessary means for a partial dealing with this root difficulty. Provisional standards and devices given us as a temporary help and guidance, because the true and total solution is beyond our present capacity and can only come when we have sufficiently evolved to see it and make it our main endeavor. So, self-subordination may become self-sabotage. Self-immolation is rarely justified. Sacrifice and self-giving is necessary but has to be wisely appointed. None of these are true solutions to the problem. None of these erase the real division between soul and other, between self and other selves. What must we do? The true solution can intervene only when by our spiritual growth we can become one self with all beings, know them as part of ourself, deal with them as if they were our other selves. For then the division is healed. The law of separate self-affirmation, leading by itself to affirmation against or at the expense of others, is enlarged and liberated by adding to it the law of our self-affirmation for others and our self-finding in their self-finding and self-realization. It has been made a rule of religious ethics to act in a spirit of universal compassion, to love one's neighbor as oneself, to do to others as one would have them do to us, to feel the joy and grief of others as one's own. But no man living in his ego is able truly and perfectly to do these things. He can only accept them as a demand of his mind, an aspiration of his heart, an effort of his will to live by a high standard and modify by a sincere endeavor his crude ego nature. It is when others are known and felt intimately as oneself that this ideal can become a natural and spontaneous rule of our living and be realized in practice as in principle. But even oneness with others is not enough by itself if it is a oneness with their ignorance. For when the law of ignorance, for then the law of ignorance will work, and error of action and wrong action will survive, even if diminished in degree and mellowed in incidence and character. Our oneness with others must be fundamental, not a oneness with their minds, hearts, vital selves, egos, even though these come to be included in our universalized consciousness, but a oneness in the soul and spirit. And that can only come by our liberation into soul awareness and self-knowledge. To be ourselves, liberated from ego, and realize our true selves is the first necessity. All else can be achieved as a luminous result, a necessary consequence. That is one reason why a spiritual call must be accepted as imperative and take precedence over all other claims, intellectual, ethical, social, that belong to the domain of the ignorance. For the mental law of good abides in that domain and can only modify and palliate. Nothing can be a sufficient substitute for the spiritual change that can realize the true and integral good, because through the Spirit we come to the root of action and existence. These mind-born schemes of philanthropy, of ethical uplift, will fail. Each of them will fail. The only way that we can change things at their root is with a changed consciousness, a recovery of our true self, and an action that stems directly from the conscious force who dominates all existence. We must live in oneness with that Mahashakti. In the spiritual knowledge of self, there are three steps of its self-achievement, which are at the same time three parts of the one knowledge. The first is the discovery of the soul, not the outer soul of thought and emotion and desire, but the secret psychic entity, the divine element within us. When that becomes dominant over the nature, when we are consciously the soul, and when mind, life, and body take their true place as its instruments, we are aware of a guide within that knows the truth, the good, the true delight and beauty of existence, controls heart and intellect by its luminous law, and leads our life and being towards spiritual completeness. Even within the obscure workings of the ignorance, we have then a witness who discerns, a living light that illumines, a will that refuses to be misled and separates the mind's truth from its error, the heart's intimate response from its vibrations to a wrong call and wrong demand upon it, the life's true ardor and plenitude of movement from vital passion and the turbid falsehoods of our vital nature and its dark self-seekings. This is the first step of self-realization. To enthrone the soul, the divine psychic individual, in the place of the ego. The next step is to become aware of the eternal self in us, unborn and one with the self of all beings. This self-realization liberates and universalizes, even if our action still proceeds in the dynamics of the ignorance. It no longer binds or misleads because our inner being is seated in the light of self-knowledge. The third step is to know the divine being who is at once our supreme transcendent self, the cosmic being, the foundation of our universality, and the divinity within of which our psychic being, the true evolving individual in our nature, is a portion, a spark, a flame growing into the eternal fire from which it was lit and of which it is the witness ever living within us and the conscious instrument of its light and power and joy and beauty. Aware of the divine as the master of our being and action, we can learn to become channels of his Shakti, the divine puissance, and act according to her dictates or her rule of light and power within us. Our action will not then be mastered by our vital impulse or governed by a mental standard, for she acts according to the permanent yet plastic truth of things, not that which the mind constructs, but the higher, deeper, and subtler truth of each movement and circumstance, and it is known to the supreme knowledge and demanded by the supreme will in the universe. The liberation of the will follows upon the liberation in knowledge and is its dynamic consequence. It is knowledge that purifies. It is truth that liberates. Evil is the fruit of a spiritual ignorance, and it will disappear only by the growth of a spiritual consciousness and the light of spiritual knowledge. The division of our being from the being of others can only be healed by removing the divorce of our nature from the inner soul reality, by abolishing the veil between our becoming and our self-being, by bridging the remoteness of our individuality and nature from the divine being who is the omnipresent reality in nature and above nature. But the last division to be removed is the scission between this nature and the supernature, which is the self-power of the divine existence. Even before the dynamic knowledge-ignorance is removed, while it still remains as an inadequate instrumentation of the spirit, the supreme Shakti or supernature can work through us and we can be aware of her workings. But it is then by a modification of her light and power, so that it can be received and assimilated by the inferior nature of the mind, life, and body. But this is not enough. There is needed an entire remolding of what we are into a way and power of the divine supernature. The integration of our being cannot be complete unless there is this transformation of the dynamic action. There must be an uplifting and change of the whole mode of nature itself, and not only some illumination and transmutation of the inner ways of the being. An eternal truth consciousness must possess us and sublimate all our natural modes into its own modes of being, knowledge, and action. A spontaneous truth awareness, truth will, truth feeling, truth movement, truth action can then become the integral law of our nature. End of Book 2, Part 1. So, these are themes that he will very much analyze in the coming section, part 2, the knowledge and the spiritual evolution. The three steps, again, the discoveries of our spiritual being, the discovery and living from our inmost soul, what he calls the psychic being. The second, to become aware of the eternal self, the Atman, Brahman, unborn, the universal reality of that. The third is to know the divine being who is the transcendent, who is the cosmic, who is secretly the source of our own psychic nature, the Purushottama, in whom transcendent universal and individual fuse, of whom, as Sat, the Divine Mother, the Mahashakti, is Chit Shakti, carries the universe forward towards its inevitable goal, which is the disclosure of the reality of this supreme nature. And this nature is not merely Prakriti. It is not the lower nature enclosed in ignorance of mind, life, and body. It is ultimately a supernature, a paraprakriti, that has to be imposed from above, that must descend on the basis of peace into us and establish here a greater world, one based on truth and union, oneness in multiplicity. So we look forward to the next book where real delight comes. I think for the moment we close the page on falsehood and evil. I don't say we won't meet it again. So since we're talking about where we're really going and what we really are, here is a reminder of your true mission and your true self from Book 3 in the Book of the Divine Mother, Canto 4, The Vision and the Boon. This is one of the great passages from Savitri. I saw the omnipotence flaming pioneers over the heavenly verge which turns towards life, come crowding down the amber stairs of birth. Forerunners of a divine multitude, out of the paths of the morning star they came, into the little room of mortal life. I saw them cross the twilight of an age, the sun-eyed children of a marvelous dawn, the great creators with wide brows of calm, the massive barrier breakers of the world, and wrestlers with destiny in her lists of will, the laborers and the quarries of the gods, the messengers of the incommunicable, the architects of immortality. Into the fallen human sphere they came, faces that wore the immortal's glory still, voices that commune still with the thoughts of God, bodies made beautiful by the Spirit's light, carrying the magic word, the mystic fire, carrying the Dionysian cup of joy, approaching eyes of a diviner man, lips chanting an unknown anthem of the soul, feet echoing in the corridors of time. High priests of wisdom, sweetness, might, and bliss, discoverers of beauty's sunlit ways, and swimmers of love's laughing fiery floods, and dancers within rapture's golden doors, their tread one day shall change the suffering earth and justify the light on nature's face. Although fate lingers in the high beyond, and the work seems vain on which our heart's force was spent, all shall be done for which our pain was born. Even as of old, man came behind the beast, this high divine successor surely shall come behind man's inefficient mortal pace, behind his vain labor, sweat and blood and tears. He shall know what mortal mind barely durst think. He shall do what the heart of the mortal could not dare. Inheritor of the toil of human time, he shall take on him the burden of the gods. All heavenly light shall visit the earth's thoughts. The might of heaven shall fortify earthly hearts. Earth's deeds shall touch the superhuman's height, earth's seeing widen into the infinite. heavy, unchanged, weighs still the imperfect world. The splendid youth of time has passed and failed. Heavy and long are the years our labor counts, and still the seals are firm upon man's soul, and weary is the ancient mother's heart. O truth, defend it in thy secret sun, voice of her mighty musings in shut heavens, on things withdrawn within her luminous depths. O wisdom splendor, mother of the universe, creatrix, the eternal's artist bride, linger not long with thy transmuting hand, pressed vainly on one golden bar of time, as if time dare not open its heart to God. O radiant fountain of the world's delight, world free and unattainable above, O bliss who ever dwells deep hid within, while men seek thee outside and never find, mystery and muse with hieratic tongue, incarnate the white passion of thy force, mission to earth some living form of thee. One moment fill with thy eternity, let thy infinity in one body live. All knowledge wrap one mind in seas of light, all love throb single in one human heart. Immortal, treading the earth with mortal feet, all heaven's beauty crowd in earthly limbs. Omnipotence, girdle with the power of God, movements and moments of a mortal will, pack with the eternal might one human hour, and with one gesture change all future time. Let a great word be spoken from the heights, and one great act unlock the doors of fate. Apropos of the mother, the mother's birthday, and the mother's month, February 2017. We'll need to meet again next Sunday in the month of March. Jai Ma, Namaste, much love to you all.